Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We have some students with us today from two high schools, and they're here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program's called Court with Class, and it is an award-winning, national award-winning program. Students are invited to attend the oral argument. If this class agrees to come, the class is given briefs that you have sent to the court. They may do extra work about the case. They then come to court, listen to the oral argument, and then after the second oral argument, they meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of this case. I'm sure that since they may be of driving age, or will soon be of driving age, that they'll find this case interesting. Let me now introduce, they look quizzical about that. Think about it. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rokensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. You will meet with Justice Wilcox at noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'm going to first ask you all to stand. Gibraltar High School, thank you for coming today. You may be seated. Conservatives School, thank you for coming. What community are you in? What community? Mm-hmm. That's a distance.
Long trip.
It's good seeing you. Drive home safely, carefully. We'll call our first case 04AP0688, Progressive Northern Insurance Company versus Edward Hall. Representing Hills Legal Group is Rick Hills. Representing Progressive Northern Insurance Company. Counsel.
The Honorable Panel, Mr. Aiki, as the Court indicated, my name is Rick Hills of Hills Legal Group in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I represent Progressive Northern Insurance Company, the petitioner, with me in court. An associate with my firm, Ms. Michelle Stoick, who assisted me in the briefing, and I'd like to publicly thank her for the same. This case, as the Court is well aware, involves a decision to be made regarding the priority of insurance coverage. And I think the important thing for the Court to know is there's no dispute about the amount of insurance coverage here. There's no coverage that is being denied to the individual that has the claim in this case. Edward Hall was a passenger in his brother's vehicle. His brother's vehicle was insured by Progressive Northern Insurance Company. Edward Hall, who is not a resident of his brother's household, so that's not an issue in this case, had his own insurance policy. Mr. Hall's insurance policy had $500,000 in UM coverage. The policy on the vehicle had $100,000 in uninsured motorist coverage. Petitioner believes that the court, consistent with both its prior decisions in Martin and Mouth, because I can tell you that the decision I'm asking for would be consistent with both, should find that general casualties policy is the primary coverage in this case. And why do I say both, you can be consistent with both, is because the Martin case dealt specifically with 632.32 sub A, when it said that the line of cases, as you look at this policy, indicates that 632.32A deals with liability insurance and not indemnity insurance. In contrast, the Mao case said certain provisions of 632.32 deal with indemnity. And I think that's the key here. How did the Supreme Court in both cases come up with that? And I think we really have to look at the form of the statute to see how those decisions can be consistent. And when I look at the statute, you start with subsection 1. It tells you what the scope is. It says this section applies to every policy of insurance issued or delivered in the state against the insured's liability for loss. So that's telling you 632.32 is about liability for loss. Subsection 2, definitions. Subsection 3 deals with required provisions. And more on 3A later, but that's talking, we get 1, 2, 3, we're dealing about liability policies and required provisions in liability policies. We then go to subsection 4 that says, you know, if you're going to have liability policies, you're also going to have uninsured motorist coverage and medical expense coverage. We then go to sub 4M, which was added later. We're also going to make you offer underinsured motorist coverage. We then go to subsection 5. Okay, you now have this liability policy. Let's talk about what the permissible provisions are going to be in the policy. And it's a policy that can include uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage. And then you go to subsection 6, which talks about prohibited provisions. And more later, but I think it's subsection 6 that when reviewing this for oral argument, they say may give us some guidance as to why we know that subsection 632.32.3A deals with liability and other areas of the statute deal with both liability and indemnity. In this particular case, what 632.32a says is coverage is provided to the named insured, applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle. Again, that is before you even discussed UM or UIM. Why did the court the legislature specifically used the language coverage provided to the named insured? Now, when we were talking back in subsection 6 about prohibited provisions, under Part B of subsection 6, it says no policy may exclude from the coverage afforded or benefits provided. And I found that the adding of the or benefits provided is really interesting, because now we're talking about clauses in the policy that we've discussed in the prior sections, and you can't exclude certain coverages and you can't take away certain benefits according to 6B. If we go back to 632.32.3A, they didn't say coverage or benefits has to be given in the same basis. They said coverage, meaning liability coverage, has to be provided equally and in the same manner as the named insured. If the legislature made that distinction in subsection 6, that's because they had to talk about all the various parts of 4M that came after 632.32.3A. And that's why the court, in reaching a decision in this case, can be consistent with Martin and can be consistent with Mao in reaching a decision that general casualties policy should be primary in this case, because 632.32.3A does not apply to indemnity policies or indemnity coverage. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about indemnity coverage. I think the briefing on both sides is relatively consistent in saying that if the court makes this decision, according to the language of the policies, general casualties policy should come first if 632.32 sub A does not apply to indemnity contracts.
Why do you think it should come first? What's your strongest argument for that position?
It's based on the language in the policies themselves, and it's a particular clause that we have. The clause in the progressive policy that says if you are not a resident or the named insured, our policy will always be excess. In the case law in Wisconsin has always said that you have to try to give full interpretation to all clauses in the policy.
What if the other policy said exactly the same thing? Then who's first?
Then it would be pro-rata is generally the way Wisconsin has decided those cases. If they say exactly the same thing, both policies are equal in what they're attempting to do, then it would go pro-rata. In our particular case, and that is, there's a great, Mr. Eike does insurance work as well. There's a great case out there that says whoever wins the law of the draftsman gets to have the priority on coverage, and that's why insurance companies are constantly looking at each other's policy language to make sure that they're consistent so that when they get in a situation like this, they're not at a disadvantage. And Mr. Eike has made a deal of that in his briefing in this case, but if Progressive Insurance Company had the foresight to see what was going to happen in this case and put a clause in their policy that puts them at an advantage, they should be allowed to have that advantage at this point in time.
Counsel, I want to look at, and you're talking about the other insurance clause of the Progressive policy. Is that what you're referring to right now?
Right.
Now, that is set forth on page 4 of your brief. The bottom other insurance policy, that's what you're referring to. Is that correct?
Right.
Now, where is that set forth in your insurance policy that's in the appendix of the opinion?
Page 103, paragraph 6.
What's page 131?
There might be a typo here.
No.
Okay.
103 is, that's the Court of Appeals opinion. Right. So
I agree. It's page, it's transpose numbers. It should be 1.
Take a look at 131.
Yeah, 131.
Yeah. That's what I was looking at because that's your policy, and yet that isn't the same, doesn't contain the same words as what you have on page 4. So that's what I'm looking for. I mean, 131 is part of the Progressive policy. That's the other insurance clause, and that's why I'm a little.
I guess it has to do with the section of that's the underinsured motorist agreement, other insurance clause. The uninsured insuring agreement begins at page 123 of the appendix and continues through page 125.
What's 131 then, that other insurance clause of the Progressive policy?
Well, let's take a look. That has to do with damage to a vehicle.
Okay, so that's the one that we're looking at, because I looked at your site in the brief, and it was to 103, and I said that's a Court of Appeals opinion. So the one that we're looking at is on page 125. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And it is in that part of the, as long as we're looking at that it says, any insurance we provide shall be excess over any other uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage except for bodily injury to you or a relative when occupying a covered vehicle. So in this particular case, he wasn't occupying his covered vehicle. He was occupying his brother's vehicle. And that being the case, his brother's vehicle, which also has UM coverage, should then be primary under the reading of the other insurance clauses. The law in this case, as we have indicated, says by Martin that differing tiers of coverage are allowed under the law, and under 632.32 sub 3A, the general casualty cannot use that because it does not apply to indemnity coverage. The other part that I'm interested in on this case is that when the Court of Appeals made its decision, our reading of it says that it wiped out Progressive's entire other insurance clause, I mean, the entire clause itself rather than just the portion of the last line. And under the Schaefer and Remeschewski cases that we cited in our brief, and counsel again did not oppose this, we believe any time that a court makes a decision striking a part of a clause in the policy, it should not take out the entire clause in the policy.
Mr. Hills, why is that important to you? I didn't fully understand why you were making that in a specific issue.
Because if the court would decide that the entire clause was gone, we would not have any other insurance clause at all. And so we would never be in a situation where we would be pro rata. We would always be first in line in every situation where we had uninsured motorist coverage because we would not have a clause at all.
So you don't want to be primary in every situation.
That's right. And really, and particularly, you're also getting the point of one of the policy considerations as to why a ruling that we're seeking here today, because Progressive Insurance Company knows their individual and what kind of cars he's going to drive in. General Casualty knows their individual and what kind of cars, and takes a risk for their amount of insurance companies. He's driving in General Casualty's car. General Casualty has made a determination of the amount of coverage that they're going to give to this car for uninsured motorist coverage. Aren't they the best ones in the position to consider the risk? And there's also the basic premises of longstanding Wisconsin law to deal with here, in that UM coverage generally attaches to the vehicle, I mean to the person, and not to the vehicle. In this particular case, you know, I heard the conversations before on liability coverage. I mean, liability coverage always goes with the vehicle first, and then it goes back to your policy. The bottom line is you have to give the effect to all the clauses in the policy. And we're just asking that our policy's clauses be given full effect in this particular case. We think 632.32 sub 3A does not apply to indemnity policies, and that is the part that the respondent is relying upon to say that the insured has to be treated the same. Mr. Hall's own policy should attach and go with him first. That's General Casualty's policy.
You know, I heard you earlier relying on the Martin case and saying that you wanted us to be consistent with both Martin and Mao. But my understanding of Martin is that Martin didn't say that 32.3A never applies to an indemnity policy. My understanding of Martin, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it basically said that it's been primarily interpreted as applying to liability policies. So aren't you pushing Martin beyond what actually is said in Martin?
You know, Ms. Stoick and I were discussing that on the way over, that the word primarily was brought up, and it was never really brought up in the briefing. And maybe the reason it's never brought up in the briefing is we've never found a case, and counsel hasn't found a case, so the word primarily just may be because that's what the court was aware of in terms of the cases it saw at that point in time. But there is no precedent of a case that says that 632.32A applies to indemnity policies.
Can't you read Mao that way?
Mao says certain parts apply to indemnity policy, and it specifically said 632.32. It didn't go into a subsection, and then it listed parts that clearly use the words uninsured motorist in it, parts that clearly use the word underinsured motorist in it, which are indemnity subsections 4 and 4M.
Well, didn't Mao call into question what had been stated in Martin? In other words, that indicating that what was stated in Martin was too broad?
Within the context of that particular case, I think that is true. Because the key point is they weren't discussing 632.32A in Mao. And the part that was seeking support of Martin in Mao tried to make Martin read broader. And I'm not here asking you to find that all parts of 632.32 apply only to liability coverage. I'm here to say that under a consistent reading of the law and the statute itself, 632.32 Part 3A applies to liability coverage, but not to indemnity coverage.
As you started your argument, though, of course, you started with 632.32.1 scope, and you did make the argument that it only applies to liability insurance because you highlighted the language against the insured's liability for loss or damage resulting from. That's the scope of 632.32. But
right.
you're saying that the phrase liability in the scope now does not relate to just liability insurance, or what I said.
The scope of this applies to the insured's liability for loss or damage.
Okay.
The legislature decided if you're going to have that, we're going to have to add, we're going to want certain indemnity provisions put in as well, and then put the limits. I mean,
so this language does not mean in scope that it only applies to liability coverage.
This says that the statute applies to liability coverage. I mean, the statute says that this section of the statute applies to liability coverage. And that's why I'm saying the entire thing applies to liability coverage. There are certain parts, subsection 4M, that as you go on also include indemnity coverage. It's adding on as we go through the statute. I mean, even subsection 4 says that UM coverage would not even have to be part of the liability policy, because at the last part of that section, it says that UM provisions shall be contained in the policy or in a supplemental thereto. At the end of the subsection 4. So arguably, I mean, insurance companies don't do it, but arguably you could take your uninsured motorist and put it as a supplement, add it on to the policy. I mean, what we see every day is that they've elected to put it all in the policy.
Let me see if I've got it straight. I think it's starting to sink in now. All right. In response to Justice Bradley's question, is what I hear you saying is that the scope of this statute, 632.32, liability applies throughout the statute. You then look at the first words of that section, except as otherwise provided, and the except as otherwise provided is provided in 4M, 5, and 6, and that adds on to the liability coverage. Is that right? In other words, liability is throughout, but different sections add to the liability.
Add to the policy, liability policy.
Liability policies. And the key words there is except as otherwise provided right at the beginning of scope.
Correct. And then 5 and 6, when you talk about permissible provisions and prohibited provisions, kick back and relate to, as the court has determined in other decisions, as to both the subparts dealing with liability and the subparts dealing with indemnification.
Let's look at 5 and 6 then. 5E is the provision of moment, I think. And that starts with a policy may provide for exclusion. Now, in our earlier case this morning, we were talking about language that says does not include, which I think it might be fair to say is another way of saying excludes, does not include, exclude. But I don't think of an other insurance clause as an exclusion. You know, we see in lots of policies and lots of things, you have, you know, who's covered, and then you have exclusions, and then you can have exceptions to the exclusion. But why would I denominate an other insurance clause and exclusion?
You're talking about the second phase of our argument.
That's
in this
right.
Case.
That's right. Dealing with dealing with 5 and 6?
Because in certain circumstances, as we say in our cases, the courts have interpreted it that it has the same effect as an exclusion. And if that would, if the court would take that analysis, if that would be the case, then we believe that this is, again, something that would be permissible under the circumstances.
Is it an exclusion under the terms of the policy?
It's an exclusion based upon the terms of the policy, based upon the status of law in Wisconsin, is what I would call it. But again, I don't want to lose too much sight on the exclusion part, only because I want to say that there is this person, Ed Hall, has $600,000 in UM coverage. Nobody is disputing that. The question is, who is responsible for the primary coverage?
Yeah, I know. It just seems that, to me, the gatekeeper term for a 5 and 6 argument is, you pull in 6, is the 5E, of course, and that the gatekeeper term of 5E is you need an exclusion. If you're not talking about an exclusion, then 5E doesn't apply. And I'm just not sure that an other insurance clause is an exclusion. I mean, it deals with when you have to pay and when you don't have to pay and, you know, who's primary and who's excess. But I'm not sure that's an exclusion. And is there anything more you can say on that?
The only thing I can say is I do not believe, Your Honor, I mean, your Justice has to reach that decision, because that only applies if you determine, I only make that argument if you decide that 632.32.3a applies to indemnity policies. And I think it's clear it does not. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ikey, representing General Casualty.
May it please the court, Mr. Hills, Ms. Stoick. My name is Stuart Ikey. I'm from the law firm of Ikey and Frakes in Milwaukee. I represent the defendant respondent in this case, General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. This case is rather interesting in one respect. We have two insurance companies that are fighting over the interpretation and meaning of Section 632.32. That doesn't happen very often. As an insurance defense lawyer, I have to be careful that when I make an argument that a particular insurance provision is contrary to a statutory requirement, I do not undermine my own insurance company or the insurance industry in general. And in this particular case, I feel quite comfortable that I'm not doing that. General Casualty and most of the other insurance companies that I am aware of interpret Section 632.32 sub 3 sub A significantly differently than Progressive interprets that language. General Casualty has, to the best of my knowledge, and most other insurance companies writing auto policies in this state, have consistently considered subsection 3A applicable to uninsured motorist coverage. And I think that it is almost self-evident, to put it that way, from the language in the statute that the legislature intended exactly the same thing. Otherwise, the legislature would not have included persons riding in vehicles among the definition of users and then said that coverage must apply to the same extent to named insured and all users if they did not expect uninsured motorist coverage to be considered under the umbrella of that particular provision. That would make absolutely no sense to write the statute that way, because passengers or occupancy insureds, but particularly passengers, are very rarely liable for automobile accidents, but they are consistently injured by uninsured motorists, and so they would also be entitled, if you follow the statutory reasoning, to protection under Section 632.32, sub 3, sub A. Why did the legislature do it? Well, the legislative history is somewhat sparse.
But I believe it's because, and I've submitted this argument in our brief, that the legislature, recognizing that Wisconsin is not a no-fault state, decided that in order to ensure protection for people who do purchase insurance, that they should also be protected against those who don't, at least to the statutory minimum limit. And so for that reason, I think it's fairly clear that subsection 3, sub A, applies to uninsured motorist coverage.
Let me, because I want to follow this. As I hear your argument, by using the term users in 3A, is it your position, in the position that you stated of many of the insurance companies, that that would be an indemnity policy, or is that still a liability policy?
Well, you've raised an issue that I have somewhat raised in the footnote in my brief. I do not like the term indemnity policy applied to uninsured motorist coverage. I think it started in the Martin case. It may have started before that. It's a stamp that has been applied to uninsured motorist coverage that I think is not entirely on all fours with the nature of the coverage. For example, MedPay coverage is indemnity coverage, and that shifts the responsibility from the insured to the insurance company. But uninsured motorist coverage may not do that. If the uninsured motorist is less at fault for the accident than the insured, there is no shift, there is no payment whatsoever. And there's also a reduction for the contributory negligence of the insured. And so I think it's a dangerous proposition to label uninsured motorist coverage indemnity insurance. And I saw that throughout the course of the cases, that this was had progressively become something that was seized upon as a justification for the case, the decisions in the cases, and I felt it was unfortunate. Ultimately, I cited the Mao case in my appellate court brief because I needed to counter that, and in Mao, this court clearly stated that under certain circumstances, at least, Section 632.32 applies to indemnity insurance. But I would urge the court to attempt to get away from that particular label in this case, if at all possible, and simply say that Section 632.32 sub 3 sub small a applies to uninsured motorist coverage regardless of what you call it, regardless of what you label it, because I think that's consistent with the purpose of the statute and the legislative intent.
I accept and appreciate that answer, but I'm not sure it quite answered my question. And my question was, under 3A, for a user in a vehicle, because I don't know what the answer is, I'm just looking for help. I want to understand this. Is a user under 3A covered under a liability policy or covered under an indemnity?
Covered under an uninsured motorist policy, and if you call that an indemnity policy, yes.
But 3A is uninsured?
3A requires the same coverage for uninsured motorist coverage. If you call that an indemnity policy, the answer is yes. The reason is...
Maybe I'm not following you. Coverage, I'm reading under 3A now, 32. Coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle described in the policy. Now, without getting to the difference between uninsured, underinsured, anything else, just that language, is that liability or is that indemnity?
It can be both. Because user includes people riding in. And it makes no sense. It's not logical to say that it's only liability coverage if you apply it specifically to users who are riding in vehicles. It makes absolutely no sense. Because the legislature would not, in my judgment, require the same coverage for the named insured and users for passengers only with respect to liability coverage. It must extend to uninsured motorist coverage as well, in my view. If you call that indemnity coverage, then it would apply to indemnity coverage.
What do the words in 3 meaning, every policy subject to this section, mean?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the
question. What do the words in subsection 3, preceding A, say, except as provided in 5, every policy subject to this section?
All right. There we're getting into something else that I think has been somewhat of an unfortunate trend in the cases. The first, the general provision of the statute applies to all policies of liability insurance.
Autos?
I think that's a generic term.
For autos? Automobiles?
Right, automobiles, liability insurance, persons of motor vehicle insurance policies, of course,
okay.
Assuming that risk. Then we have policy of insurance issued or delivered, which includes all these kinds of coverages. Okay, MedPay, UM, possibly UIM. Then we go down to sub 3 in answer to Your Honor's question. The coverage provided to the named insured, this is the policy subject to this section. I say the whole section, 632.32.
Covers all motor vehicle.
Motor vehicle liability insurance policies with all those separate kinds of coverage in them.
That's what I'm asking.
That's consistent with the legislative purpose, in my view, to provide protection in a state that does not require no fault, that is not a no-fault state.
Because that's why you keep saying it doesn't matter what the
right.
provision in the policy is. It covers all the provisions in the policy.
All provisions in the policy that, underneath that particular section have to apply to the named insured and anyone who is a user as defined there.
And you then say a passenger is a user.
Passenger is obviously a user, somebody who's riding in under subsection 2, small c.
How old is the omnibus statute?
Old. Before I started practicing, almost 30 years ago, I don't really know exactly when it came into being.
In the 20s, I think.
Okay. It's always been, as far as I know. In one form or another.
But it's been amended.
Oh, many times. It's been, it had been much different, in a much different form many, many years ago. But as insurance companies, as we all know, they are inclined to do, make their policies increasingly more complex, then these types of provisions had to be amended.
Well, do you know whether subsection 3 and subsection 4 came into the statute at the same time?
Oh, no. Another thing I wanted to address this morning with the court was the possible consequence of overturning the Court of Appeals decision. I think that the court may wish to consider what those consequences are. We alluded in our brief to the fact that it will result in a flurry of redrafting of policies. Many insurance companies are going to say, well, we've been doing it wrong for all these years. Maybe we ought to eliminate Progressive's competitive advantage. I think that that's a legitimate thing to consider. I think as I read the case law, this court has on occasion lamented the fact that there is an awful lot of draftsman battles going on. So that's a consideration. But aside from that, what could happen is that insurance companies could then follow the same factual scenario that existed in the American Hardware case, which was a UIM case. But they might then say, okay, fine, Mr. Occupancy Insured, we're only going to give you $25,000 in uninsured motorist coverage, regardless of what the named insured has. Now, in American Hardware, we recall it was underinsured, but the limit for the named insured was substantially higher than the limit for the occupancy insured. The court found that okay because it was UIM coverage. And again, I'm drawing a distinction between UIM and UM because UM is required and UIM is not. But assuming that this court were to overturn the Court of Appeals, I think that the insurance companies could very legitimately come back and say, we're only going to provide $25,000 in UM coverage now because we don't have to, for occupancy insureds, because we do not have to provide the same coverage anymore, the same uninsured motorist coverage that we provide to our named insureds. I think that would be an unfortunate result, and I think that those that particular kind of result would lead to more litigation and probably create some problems between occupants of vehicles, maybe even inter-family members. I don't know. So I would urge the court not to do that.
Is there any attempt in the general casualty policy to have an other insurance exclusion?
The general casualty policy in this particular instance assumes that Progressive's uninsured motorist coverage would be primary.
How does it do that?
It is written as any insurance we provide, we're talking, excuse me, uninsured motorist coverage now.
What page of the appendix?
Page 4 of Mr. Hill's brief, of petitioner's brief. Any insurance we provide with respect to a vehicle you do not own shall be excess over any collectible insurance providing such coverage on a primary basis. And so what they're doing is they're saying we provide excess, and this is generally consistent with the scheme that most insurance companies follow. This is why the light went on when I saw Progressive's policy, because I hadn't seen anything like this before. The insurance coverage provided by the insurer of the vehicle, uninsured motorist coverage, assumes that everybody in that vehicle is going to be primary. So if the named insured then is in another person's car, the insurance company assumes, general casualty does, that they've got the primary coverage. And so they say, we're providing excess because we're assuming they're primary. And so it says, we're providing such we're excess to anything providing coverage on a primary basis. That's the assumption. Well, Progressive comes along and says, our coverage is excess to anything. And so it just flips the whole thing. But we're not arguing ambiguities. We're not arguing that all of this is inappropriate. This is what insurance companies do. But I think it's inconsistent with the requirement in the statute that the same coverage be provided to the named insured and occupancy insured, because it's clearly not. Their primary coverage for their named insured is not the same that they are providing for the occupancy insured. One other thing that I wanted to address very briefly, there has been some discussion, and Justice Bradley, you mentioned this too, with respect to the exclusions in the case. I never thought that this was an exclusion, and we did not argue that. We didn't argue that this was an impermissible exclusion because it had the effect of excluding a blood relative or a passenger. That's not my argument. The petitioner kind of danced around that a little bit in their brief, but I would urge the court not to focus on that as a reason for its decision in any respect. I think that this case can very easily be decided by simply saying that Section 632.32 sub 3 sub small a applies to uninsured motorist coverage, and that Progressive's policy does not, in fact, provide the same coverage to its named insured and the occupancy insureds. Therefore, that provision of their policy must be stricken or not given effect, not voided entirely, perhaps, if that's a concern, but at least not given effect. And therefore, they have primary insurance. Go back to general casualties language. You have primary or excess. That's the way the scheme usually works and has worked in my experience.
Tell me, is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision that bothers you? I know you won under it, but in terms of good insurance law.
Well, it might have gone a little bit more further than I thought it should have gone. There was a lot of discussion about the Mao case. As I said before, I think the Mao case is a good case. It's good law. It talks about indemnity insurance and the applicability of 632.32 to indemnity insurance. But I was getting those questions at the Court of Appeals, and I was trying to move it away from that, as I did here today. I think that that is not the best way to decide this case. I think it can be done just on the statute. And I don't like giving labels to uninsured motorist coverage.
You'd feel the same way about underinsured, because that's covered in these provisions.
Well, now you're getting into another area. Underinsured, I draw distinctions.
It's not required.
I draw distinctions there.
Okay.
I think that's a whole different animal, because if you start to do that, then what you have to do is you've got to overrule American Hardware, because American Hardware specifically said this is okay with UIM coverage. That's why we got involved in this whole row, is because Progressive said it's the same, and we said no, it's not.
Because I think it was the Progressive policy that bunches up UIM and UM
right.
in that
well,
provision.
Some do. You've got to read those policies very carefully to sift out those things. But, yeah, that happens on occasion, unfortunately.
Counsel, would you address the argument of Progressive, where they take issue with the Court of Appeals, which indicated that the entire other insurance provision is invalidated as opposed to a part of it?
I said in our brief, too, I didn't interpret it that way. I think that Progressive was concerned about that because they were concerned about the effect of it. I don't see that it's necessary to invalidate it, per se, if it has the effect that Progressive thinks it has. I think that they're just concerned about somebody coming along and citing that decision and saying, uh-oh, you've got all this coverage now because the Court of Appeals wiped that right out of your policy. And I don't think that that was really what the Court of Appeals intended. It may have been a little bit more, say, not lack of careful drafting in the opinion, and perhaps it should be addressed. But I have absolutely no concern about just saying that this provision of Progressive's policy violates the omnibus provision 632.32.3 sub small a, and that is unenforceable without voiding the whole clause if that is Progressive's concern. You say it's unenforceable, then it becomes, then you say the same coverage must apply to the occupancy insured as the named insured. It's primary for the named insured, therefore it's primary for the occupancy insured. All right. Thank you very much for considering General Casualty's position.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hills?
Thank you. First of all, I guess I would say with all due respect to this astute body, I don't think it's your decision to determine whether or not somebody's going to be at a competitive advantage. Your decision has to be based upon what the law is in this case, in this state, and what the statutes say, and whether or not Progressive has complied with the statute when they drafted their policy. General Casualty also raises a straw man. And this brings me back to the point. There is a straw man about the driver having a lot of UM coverage and the passenger not having a lot of UM coverage. Let's go back to 6B, okay? That was the one that I told you said no policy may exclude from the coverage afforded or benefits provided. And that was the or benefits. And under sub 2A, any person who is a named insured or passenger in or on the insured vehicle with respect to bodily injury, sickness, or disease, including death, resulting therefrom to that person. They can't exclude benefits or change the benefits for the people under 6B, sub 2.
Mr. Hills, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Eike, because I'm just trying to get a handle on this. I want to make sure I understand it correctly. Under sub 3A, coverage provided to name insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle. Now, you've argued the difference between indemnity and liability. For the user that's in that vehicle that would be covered under this section, is that an indemnity policy or a liability policy?
Liability policy. And the reason being is what I said in the beginning. We're talking about liability policies of insurance, and then it says coverage provided to the named insured. And we're talking about coverage. And coverage is to what? Coverage is to protect. Okay? That's why you're getting this coverage. And that's why they said these are for liability policies issued in the states. What is indemnity? I mean, counsel is playing a fine line by saying you shouldn't call uninsured motorists an indemnity policy or you shouldn't call UIM insurance an indemnity policy. The reason the court has referred to it as indemnity type situations in the past is because what do you get because there's uninsured motorists in your policy? You get money.
Well, let me follow up, though, because I think Mr. Eike makes a point. I'm just, like I say, this is not my primary area, so I'm trying to understand it.
Okay.
But I think his point would be the guy that's in the passenger seat of the vehicle that's not driving, that's not at all responsible for the accident, how is that individual liable for anything? If we're talking about liability coverage.
Well, there are situations where a passenger can be liable.
There are, but under this setting, where the passenger is seated in the vehicle,
right.
It's obviously covered under 3A. The passenger doesn't do anything to cause the accident. How is that liability?
Well, it's not every using is done in different circumstances. There's different types of use. You could be using the vehicle as a passenger reaching over and grabbing the steering wheel and grabbing it that way and causing the accident. You could be using the vehicle by directing the other person what to do as they're driving. So there are circumstances where that would apply. Sure, there's a broad definition of use that applies in certain circumstances. There's all sorts of different uses.
But the statute doesn't seem to limit coverage to a user that causes an accident. The statute seems to cover an individual who's in the vehicle.
And if they're using it in a way that they need coverage,
all right,
they get coverage the same way as the driver does. That's what I'm saying. They get coverage the same way as the driver does if they're using the vehicle in a way that they need the coverage. Again, they could have said coverage or benefits are provided the same way, just like they did in subsection 6. The legislature did not say coverage or benefits in 3A. They said coverage or benefits in 6B. And as I was making my point, UM insurance, you get money back later. UIM insurance, you get money back later. And so that there is a benefit to having that coverage.
Every liability policy in the state requires UM coverage. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the scope, 632.32, deals with a policy, every liability policy. That would subsume, it seems to me it would subsume uninsured motorist coverage because every liability policy has to have uninsured motorist coverage.
The point I made before is that's what has happened in practice. But under subsection 4, it says you don't even have to have that be part of the policy, the uninsured motorist. It can be a supplement.
It can be an endorsement to the policy.
It doesn't say endorsement. It says it's a supplement to the policy.
What is a supplement to the policy? God knows we've got insurance, lots of insurance. And I don't know of any document that's called a supplement to the policy. What is it?
It's something that the insurance companies have elected not to use,
It's something that doesn't exist.
At this point in time, I would say yes. But in terms of when the statute was enacted, that's what was allowed.
That's different than an endorsement. I mean, you can label a document supplement, amendment, additional, endorsement. I mean, no matter how you label it, it becomes an attachment to that policy unless you set it up as a very separate kind of policy.
And the question then, I guess, is whether it's a coverage or a benefit.
Could I ask Chief?
Justice Brasser.
Is subsection 3 of the present law come to be part of the omnibus statute substantially at a substantially different time from subsection 4?
I do not know the answer to that question. I do know the answer to your other question, that the statute started in 1925, but that's about the extent I can get from the materials I have at hand.
Would it make any difference if 4 came in much later than 3?
Based on my argument, I would say yes, because I think it's the order of the statute that makes the definition being what it is by how we see 4 is described, 4M, 5, and 6. I don't want to say what I think because I don't know what the prior form of the statute was. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hills. Thank you, Mr. Hills, and thank you, Mr. Eike, for your enlightening discussion on uninsured motorist and priority of claims and payments. That concludes our hearing in 04AP0688. The court will be in recess until 1:30. The students should remain, and Justice Wilcox will be out shortly to talk with you, and you will be joined by students who were earlier today. We're in recess.